Lali Sokolov was born in Slovakia, in Eastern Europe. As a young man, he was good-looking and charming. After the war, he married a woman named Gita, whom he'd known for several years. They migrated to Melbourne, where they started a family. When Heather Morris was introduced to Lali, he was in his 80s. His wife, whom he adored, had died, and now he was ready to tell his story. The story of how he and Gita had come together. Lali had met Gita when he was tattooing a number on her forearm at Auschwitz concentration camp. Lali had been given the job of tattooist, a privileged position in the camps, so that each prisoner could be identified, alive or dead. In the process of tattooing Gita, a woman he'd never met before, Lali said he fell instantly in love. Heather Morris's book is based on Lully's story, and it's called The Tattooist of Auschwitz. Hi, Heather.
Hello, Richard. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
How did you meet Lully?
I met him when a friend of mine knew a friend of his son's, Gary, and I had written a couple of screenplays, and she knew I had an interest in writing stories that were based on reality or true events. And she, over coffee, she said to me, oh, look, I know this person, and his dad's apparently got a story that could be worth telling. Do you want to meet him?
So you went over to his place? Where was he living at the time?
He had lived in an apartment in Balaclava in Melbourne. And yes, 30th of December 2003, I knocked on his door to be greeted by him and two dogs standing either side of him, one the size of a small pony, the other smaller than my cat. And all my rehearsals of Happy Hanukkah went out the door as he just said to me, come, turned and walked around and walked back inside.
What was his apartment like when you were brought in there? Was it a museum to their past together or what was it like?
It certainly was a well to the 1960s. It was immaculate. It had the fine polished furniture. There was no doubt about the fact that Lully and Gita obviously had kept this home immaculate. It was almost like a showpiece. Very organised, very ordered, and we sat down at the dining table.
How long had he been a widower at that point? How long had he been, was it after his wife had died?
About 8 or 9 weeks.
Oh, that's all?
Yeah, that's all.
That's all. So is that why he was ready to tell his story then, at that point?
Very much so. And for the first several times I saw him, he kept harassing me. How long are you going to take to write this story? You need to be quicker. And I'm not writing anything at this point. I didn't even take any writing material with me. I just sat and listened. And I said, what's the rush, Lully? And he said, I need to be with her. I need to be with Gita. So you have to hurry up. I don't want to stay here anymore. And he was talking about the world, this world.
Was it hard to gain his trust at first, though, to get him to tell you stories?
Yes, of course. He pretty much told me a lot of facts initially. And they were facts possibly that I could have researched and found out. But in between them, he would let something slip that I knew had a deeper meaning to him. But I'm a stranger and he had to get to know me. And his doggies had to get to know me. It became a four-way street, actually.
The dogs had a role there in the trust process?
Very much so. In fact, it was about 3 months in from my meeting him 2 to 3 times a week sometimes that one day the doggies brought the tennis ball that he used to throw to them. They brought it back, the big dog, and put it on my lap. And he tried to take it, and the dog wouldn't let him have it. And so I put my hand down into the dog's mouth, and she released the tennis ball. And at that point he went, ah, my doggies like you. I like you. Yes, you can tell my story. And that was the moment when I actually for the first time felt that he was now going to tell me his story.
How did you get the story down? Did you record it? Did you take notes?
Nothing in front of him for many months. I would frantically go home and try and transcribe what he'd said. Occasionally I'd grab a piece of paper and I said, would you spell that for me? Because he's saying words which were foreign to me. Tätevera, politisch Abteilung. And I'm going, I don't know what these are. He clearly didn't want to explain things to me. He just wanted to talk. So occasionally he wrote them down, but initially, no, I just went and sat and listened, and we chatted pretty much like you and I are.
Huh, so it came out like a torrent then, did it?
Absolutely.
And he didn't want to be stopped with you saying, mm-hmm. Oh, what's that? How do you spell this? Where was that?
Yeah, totally bullet speed, rapid fire, with very little connection between
going,
many
wait,
of the
wait,
stories.
Hang on, were you? Right.
Back up.
Right. So was your plan to write a book initially or a movie? Or what
screenplay.
Was the screenplay.
Okay. I'd been studying both here and in the US, writing a screenplay. I quite like that as a medium. I don't know why, when in reality, 1% of 1% of 1% of films ever get made. But I did. And that really tickled his fancy once he got his head around the concept of it being a screenplay. Because then, of course, it became about, well, who's going to play me?
How did he want to play him in the movie then?
Initially, it was Brad Pitt. He said, get me Brad Pitt. He's a good-looking boy, and I was a good-looking boy. And even then I had to say, look, I had to tell you, Lally, but he's too old. You know, can we move on? So we then had to start going to movies and find me someone who can play me. And I took him to the movie The Notebook and said, look, there's a good-looking boy in here. His name's James Marsden. Tall, dark, handsome. I think he's perfect for you. So we sit down at the Jam Factory in Melbourne and The Notebook comes on. James Marsden comes on. He turns to me, yeah, he's okay. I come, okay. About 5 minutes later, naked from the waist up, Ryan Gosling comes on the screen. Lally stands up and loudly to everybody in the theatre, that's me. He should be me. Don't you think he looks like me? He's some 87, 88 at this stage, and Ryan Gosling, sort of a 25-year-old hunk. And I pulled him down and sat him down. And a few minutes later, Gosling's back on. He does it again. And everybody in the audience turned around and gave him a round of applause. And at that point, he had the validation. He had chosen correctly. We could now watch the movie in silence.
Let the word go forth, Ryan Gosling, you've passed the audition there to play Lally in the movie of this.
He only had one female ever that he considered worthy of playing Gita, and that was Natalie Portman.
Oh.
He was spellbound by her.
Nonetheless, how did you feel about this, Heather, the responsibility of writing this story as an outsider, and a non-Jewish outsider?
Initially, I didn't know where I was going to be writing it and how I was going to be writing it. And then my family started complaining to me when I would come home from being with him, saying, you're coming home pretty down these days. What's going on? You're depressed. I would go home. They would say, how's Lally today? And I'd say, he's fine. And I'd brush them off. And they said, something's going on with you. And I spoke to a colleague of mine in the social work department at Monash Medical Center. I said, look, I know what's going on here. I said, but I don't think I want to see Lally at the moment. I need time out. And she looked at me. She said, oh, Heather, what are you going on about? She said, it's a classic case of transference.
Transference, yeah.
As he was unburdening, I was getting out, and that made the responsibility all the more greater for me. And so I then had to just find ways to deal with that and strategies to leave him. So I got the correct advice from a mental health advisor. Always leave him after you've shut him down. Do not have a conversation about his time there and walk away. Go on to support, go on to your family, his family. But the importance of shutting down someone who has experienced such a traumatic event would then make it that much easier for them to then continue their day or their evening. And that worked in reverse for me too. We moved away from what I was there for, and that's where our friendship then started to grow.
So where did he grow up?
In a small town called Krompaki, which is in Slovakia, about 200-odd kilometres away from Bratislava, the capital. Small town. His dad was the equivalent of a taxi driver, but with a horse and cart. And he ferried people from the train station to their homes who needed to be moved around in Krompaki. And Lally had a way with languages. It was picked up in his school quite early on. He could grasp them without any teaching. He was smart. And as he grew up and got into trouble with his dad, because he always knew he wanted to get out of Krompaki, that the lifestyle he saw his dad leading, he didn't want that for him. And I think in some ways later in his life, when he talked about his parents, that was one area he had a touch of shame about, that he didn't help his dad out when he was meant to, got into trouble for it, but he kept saying, I do not want to be like my dad.
So he was headed for the bright lights of what, Bratislava or even bigger than that, Prague perhaps, or Berlin, I don't know.
And when he left school, he got the equivalent of an internship, no, because it was being paid, but instead of going to university or higher education, he was one of a handful of bright young men and women in Slovakia who, the Barter Corporation, who were the biggest employer in Czechoslovakia.
Right, the shoes, you mean, like the shoes and everything else.
But it was shoes, it was armaments, it was everything. They made a massive amount of things. They made aircraft. Yes, and so he got a role there, and they took an X number each year of the best and the brightest, and he got one of these apprenticeship-type roles with Barter and very quickly rose through the ranks there, namely because of his language ability, found himself in the export department of Bata, where he could, Germany was one of the countries they were exporting a lot of stuff to.
So this is where he was when war broke out, after the Nazi occupation, which is a complicated story to tell of what was Czechoslovakia.
He did decide to leave Bata after 2 or 3 years, and he went to Bratislava and became the manager in the largest department store, or one of the senior managers in this large department store. He wanted to interact with the public. This guy was a ladies' man. He was such an outgoing, I need to interact more with the public, not with the Germans who I'm selling armaments to.
So he was a sharply dressed, good-looking young man who spoke several languages and was obviously very bright, and had ended up running a department store when war broke out. Now, this was Czechoslovakia as the state was back then, and this is the Slovakian end of it. So it's complicated to tell the story of how it ended up coming under the thumb of the Nazis, but it eventually did. What happened to him after the Nazi takeover, effectively, of Slovakia?
It was about November of 1941 that his employers said to him, "I'm sorry, all Jewish people have got to go." The word had come from Berlin. No Jewish people were allowed to be employed anywhere in Slovakia. And so he left there, and they were getting word of the nasties going on in other parts of Europe. So he went back home to Krumpaki, to his family, to be with them, thinking that we all need to be together now. We need to support each other. We don't know what's coming.
So then the Germans announced a scheme to conscript for labour young men and women from each family. How did that scheme work? Was that?
They had signs put up on every shop window in every town saying every family had to give a child over the age of, I think it was about 14 or 15. And if any family who had such a child didn't give one, then the whole family would be taken away. And then the premise was that they were to be going to work for the Germans. So his older brother said, I'm the oldest. But his older brother was married with 2 children, and the lady wouldn't hear of it. And his sister going just was never an option for him.
This is 1941 we're talking about, 42? Thereabouts.
Early 42.
Early 42.
Yes.
What did he and the Jewish population at the time, or anyone in fact in that area, know of the existence of, first of all, concentration camps they would have been aware of? What about extermination camps? Was there knowledge that these were in place or are being set up? What knowledge did they have?
They had none. In fact, I don't think the word concentration camp was even in their vocabulary. They knew about work camps because they were hearing people being taken to work camps. And that was all they knew. Death camps, concentration camps, no. You would have tried to flee, I think, if you had of
yes, you would have dropped everything
in that.
Yeah. So what happened when he put his hand up and reported to the authorities for work?
Yes, he was then told to be at a certain place in Prague on a certain date, and he went there, and he spent about 3 or 4 weeks in a school, just sort of being housed in the school as they were rounding up these young people from all over Slovakia. So he was with the 40 or 50 people from Krumpaki, but they were rounding them up. And it wasn't until they had 1,500 young men in the school that the train pulled in one day, and they were marched to a train. Okay, now you're going to work.
What did he tell you about that train journey?
Horrendous. For one thing, they were being ushered onto this train by Slovakian army personnel carrying weapons, who up until the day before they considered themselves to be a citizen of Slovakia, just like the Slovakian army. Now, all of a sudden, they're pointing their rifles at them and saying, "Get onto this train." And it's a cattle train. Many, many carriages. He couldn't tell me how many. And he was shoved onto a cart, one of these trains, along with as many people as they could squash on. 2 buckets of water to last them however long the journey was, and 2 buckets to toilet in. That was it.
How long were they in that train for?
2.5 days.
And when the train arrived, what happened then?
It stopped, and for the first time in 2.5 days, they heard the doors being opened on the carts. They could hear the clang of the metal. These were carts designed to carry cows. They're pretty solid. And they all sort of filed out or jumped out, because there was no platform per se, and hit the ground. Many men with legs that didn't want to work because they hadn't moved for 2.5 days. And he saw for the first time the SS, and he recognised the insignia on their uniform.
Death's head, yeah.
Well, they had that double bolt of lightning.
Oh, yeah.
And there were dogs yapping. And whenever he saw right away that first few moments, a man fall and just be shot on the spot because he didn't get back up quick enough. And from that moment on, he knew this is no work camp.
This was Auschwitz.
This was Auschwitz, number one.
Did he see the famous sign, you know, Arbeit macht frei, you know, work makes you free?
He had to march through it. And they were marched from where the train pulled in and told to leave all their belongings. He had a suitcase full of goodies in it from Mom. Mom had sent him books. You must keep reading books. But that was all taken immediately from them. And yes, they marched through those gates. And because he spoke and read German, he looked up and he read the words.
I often wonder what the... what those prisoners made of those words above, if they believed in any way or felt that they had to believe the promise that if they worked hard, they'd be set free at some point. I wonder. We can't know.
I don't know about the others, but I know Lully didn't. Mm. He just seen people being shot for no other reason other than they didn't get up off the ground quick enough. So if that was happening there, then once you got inside those gates, you know, all bets were off.
And we now know, Heather, there were two Auschwitzes. There's the Auschwitz I, the first camp,
yes,
which was smaller, and then the much larger camp, Auschwitz-Birkenau, which was, what, how far away? 4 kilometres?
About 4 kilometres away.
Right. And he would have been sent to the second one, wouldn't he?
He was marched there the day he arrived, after he had been tattooed himself, showered, if you can call it that, shaved, and put into a Russian army uniform. All their belongings got taken.
And Russian army uniform.
Yes. And they found out when they got to Birkenau that the people currently at Birkenau who were building the blocks were actually Russian prisoners of war. And he met a couple of them and spoke to a couple who thought it was ironic that they were given rubbishy clothes and then their uniform was given to the prisoners. And so initially, yes, he wore this Russian prison uniform.
So what was his job, such as it was, after he arrived there?
Everybody's job on those 1,500 who came in on that day was to build the camp. And he said he got a job working on the roof, tiling straight away. And from up there, he could look around and see the area that had been enclosed and just knew straight away, this was massive. If they filled this area with blocks like they were building, then this was going to be something that was being built to house tens of thousands of people.
I wonder, again, if there's any part of him that was just incredulous. Because, I mean, one of the problems there was in alerting the world to this catastrophe was how utterly mad it was that you'd build such a thing. And,
yes.
And yet there it was.
There it was. And but in those days when he got there, there was only, well, I don't know, he was in block 7. So I think there was probably only about 9 or 10 of these blocks at that stage built. And so, you know, there ended up being literally hundreds in the end.
How long before he got sick, and how sick was he?
Pretty sick. He just collapsed one day, and yes, he was taken out by the other people in the block and thrown on a death cart. He had typhoid, and that was probably within about 5 or 6 weeks of arriving, so fairly soon. And as he said, you know, he was scheduled to die within weeks of arriving in Auschwitz, and he should have.
So why didn't he die? What protected him?
Yeah, an incredible story. This young man who he shared a bed with in his block, we shared it with 3 or 4, he came out and he knew Lully wasn't dead. He was just unconscious. And as the SS went into the next block to get the dead in there, or the dead and dying, Aaron started pulling him off the cart. He was going to save him. And Pepan, who turned out to be the tattoo bearer at the time, he saw this and he came over and he helped him. And so the two of them dragged Lully back into the block, way down the back, and put him up on the top bunk. And for the next 7 or 8 days, during the day, Pepin would sneak back in, bringing him water, wet cloths for his head. And at night time, his fellow inmates looked after him.
What was his story, Pepin, his saviour?
Pepin was a French academic who had been imprisoned, not because of his religion, but because of his politics. Teaching at a university in Paris. He'd become outspoken and, was grabbed and found himself there.
So was it Pepin then that gave him a job, so to speak, or recommended him for the job as tattooist alongside him?
Yes, absolutely. Pepin, when he was recovering, brought him outside one day and told him what had happened to him because Lully had no recollection. And Pepin said to him, look, I just might be able to help you. would you like to work with me? And he turned him down flatly. No way am I going to be, you know, marking people's bodies for however short their life is or long their life is. Didn't want a bar of it. He said, but it just may save you. And he said, why do you want to do this for me? And Pepin responded, I saw a young man saving your life. I figure he might be somebody worth saving. And so he went, okay. He said, someone's going to do it. It may as well be you. You can go back up onto the roof of the block and you're very weak. You won't last long. Or you can come and work with me. And so he did.
Are you saying he felt a kind of shame about the job of being tattooist? He felt shame about that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he'd had it done to him. And how dare you reduce me to a number? And here he was now being asked to do the same thing.
How did he talk about that? Was he shame about this still evident, even in talking to you all these years later?
A little bit. But he knew somebody was going to do it. He said he had to rationalise it. And him not doing it didn't mean it wouldn't happen. And Lully was always a survivor in everything he did. And he kept telling himself, I have to survive. I have to survive. So, yep, here's an opportunity. Thank you. I now will take it.
Oh, I mean, it's a situation that brought on extraordinary moral choices, that almost unthinkable moral choices upon people.
Well, they're choiceless choices.
Yes. How did the tattooing process work? Did he talk about that?
Yes, he described it to me. Being Lully, it was described very quickly. And I just went like this, he would say, banging on his arm. But when I got him to, you know, a little bit more detail, please. They had blocks of wood, small little blocks of wood. I've seen a picture of them. They're about, excuse my imperial measurements, an inch and a half long by about 6 inches deep. And they embedded pins, he called them, but they were actually needles, got embedded into them. And with those, you could puncture the skin and you would quickly punch out the number and then rub green ink into them.
Well, like, so he'd like, there's a series of dots.
A series of dots.
Dots along the arm.
You try and join them together tap. And they would drag. But he said you just tried to be gentle. But if you went gentle, you didn't go deep enough. You had to do it again.
And then you rub the ink across that.
Rub the ink through it and it then embedded into your skin.
What was the job like, did he say, the actual process of it? How difficult was it?
Well, you had to get quick or you got into trouble because he had SS standing around them all times. And the process of it, he got through it by never looking at anybody he was tattooing, except for one or two instances. But he could not look them in the eye. And yes, I suppose that was his shame coming through. But he did it and he kept doing it.
What sort of a relationship did he have with his SS minder, the man who was looking over his shoulder?
Barizzi got made his minder. After about a month or so, he reported for work one day and Pepin wasn't there. And the commandant who was in charge of the selections, a chap called Hustig, he came up to Lully and said, get to work. And he said, where's Pepin? And he was told, that's none of your business. You are now the tattooer. And that was it. No job description. No application. And he turned and walked away, leaving him to say, okay, you know, I can stand here and get a bullet in the head by saying, no, thank you. But he didn't. He just fell into it like that.
And we know what happened to Pepin, don't we? But do we really know? Did he ever find out what happened?
No, we didn't. And researchers tried to locate him, but we couldn't, mostly because Lully couldn't remember his surname, which didn't help. But it's expected that he disappeared. That would have been about July, August, 42.
So what a relationship did Lully then have with his SS minder?
Well, Barizzi he described to me as being just an uneducated oaf. And Lully worked him out quite quickly. He was a bragger. Every challenge he threw at Lully, I bet you can't do 10 of them in the next 5 minutes, Lully would automatically rise to. And in a funny, convoluted kind of way, they started talking and having conversations. Lully found out his weaknesses, and in essence, he manipulated him. He let him believe that he was a friend, and, well, not even a friend, but someone he could talk to. He gave him advice on his love life. And Barizzi took it.
And then one day he meets Geeta, who comes in to have her arm tattooed. You said he didn't look at the people he was tattooing. Why did he look this time?
For the first time, girls were brought from Birkenau from Auschwitz. And Geeta had been in Auschwitz since April. And so more blocks are built. They decide to move the girls now into the female camp. and for the first time. And he says to Pepin straight up, "No way, no, no, not girls." He said, "That is defiling their bodies. I can't do that." Again, Pepin said to him, "Okay, walk away, but someone else will do it. You can stay here and do it. And maybe you can make the process in some way simpler or easier for them, but someone's going to do it."
So what was different about Geeta?
Geeta, he handed him the piece of paper with her number on it. She had already been tattooed when she arrived, but her number had faded, and so it had to be redone. And as he was about to begin it, one of the doctors came along and started examining her the way they did, running his hands over her body, and he felt her starting to speak. And so he looked up and he mouthed the words, "Shh."
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So just then you were saying how the women were being brought to him to be tattooed.
Yes.
And Geeta came to him one day.
Yes.
And what happened after he saw her?
Well, here was this 18-year-old girl dressed in rags with a shaven head and terrified, trembling with fear. And so, yes, he looked up and he looked into her eyes and he just said, "Shh." He did not want her to speak. He knew that everybody was told, "Say nothing, just process." And she looked back at him and he said, in that moment, he knew he could never love another. Hopelessly in love, his head fell to the ground. He finished tattooing her numbers. He looked up, gave her a smile. She gave him a smaller one back. And then she turned and walked away.
Did he explain why? What it was that was so striking about her? Could he explain it?
Yeah, eyes. And if you look at a photo of Geeta, you can see why. She had eyes which he said were black. They were, in fact, just the deepest, deepest brown. And they held everything that he ever wanted in a person. They had the love, the sensitivity that he saw. He just saw in her this person that he knew was behind the eyes, not this trembling, scared girl standing in front of him.
So who was this woman, Geeta?
Geeta was also from Slovakia, from a different town, a few hundred kilometres away from him. And she had been in Auschwitz with a group of girls. She had been a seamstress back in her hometown. And she also had given herself up. She had two older brothers. Now, the reason they hadn't been rounded up when they were coming through their town, they in fact had left home and gone and joined the resistance. So when the word came that her family had to give over a child, she was the middle of three girls. And she said she would go. And all the family arguments happened, of course. No, none of you are going. But no, she said, "I have to go. Somebody has to go or they'll take you all." And so she put her hand up, just like Lali had.
So how did Lali then and Geeta establish a courtship under these utterly bizarre and cruel circumstances?
He just kept looking for her. Whenever the prisoners were not working, they had sort of a few hours off on a Sunday and they would mingle in the compound and around the area in Birkenau where he could. He would go looking for her. Now, he had a position that was classified in some ways as privileged, and he doesn't shy away from that, and neither do I, because he was a tattooist. He had a degree of freedom of movement. He had to go to the women's camp because he had to go there to tattoo people. He carried a bag with him that had his tools with him. He didn't have to hand it back every day. He could walk around. And if ever he was confronted by somebody from the SS, being in a place he shouldn't be, or why aren't you with somebody, he would hold the bag up and say the words, "Politisch Abteilung," which translated to political wing. And the political wing was actually run out of Berlin, not out of Auschwitz. And even the SS would say, "Okay, I'll leave you alone."
Wow. God, what a risk, though.
Absolutely. He said they still could have shot him. But he had a bravado that just let him go front and centre. Here's my bag.
And what was possible under those circumstances? Conversation? Flirting? Or what?
There's a lot of flirting, but if you can imagine an area with thousands and thousands of prisoners all just mingling around, just trying to not be working per se. And so all these people were unwittingly providing them with cover. And Agita's friends would often encircle the two of them, the other woman in the block, so that from any SS, they would just be wandering around, mingling amongst them. But yes, they were able to then have these conversations and get to know each other whenever they could, by virtue of the fact that they were being hidden in plain sight by thousands of prisoners.
I don't know how to ask this question, Heather, but did they ever get any special alone time?
Yes, they did.
They did?
They did.
What? How? How?
Once again, Lully being Lully, he had a nasty incident happen in the camp where he had been taken into a gas chamber and seen en masse the hundreds of people who had just been killed. And just said, I have to get out of here. And when he got out of there and got away from him, his minder, who, by the way, as they were leaving the gas chamber, slapped him on the back and said, hey, Tetevera, I think you're the only Jew that ever walked into a gas chamber and then walked out again. He went to the block where Geeta, he knew she was in. She wasn't there. She was working in the administration building and said to the block leader there, get me Geeta. I have to see Geeta. And that one time, because he was so distraught, this block elder, and he handed her a block of chocolate because he had managed to get contraband. And she went and brought Geeta back to the block in the middle of the day when everybody else was at work.
How was he when he told you that story? Did he smile?
Did he ever? The head would go down, the blushing would start, the grin would come on. And I swear that when he would talk about that, he actually could transport himself back to that place and that time. And he might have been telling me, but he was in fact with Geeta. And a lovely little sidebar to that story involving their son, Gary, who was now an adult man. I wrote the first draft of the screenplay and presented it to Lully at one of his birthdays. And he and his son Gary and I are sitting at the table, and Gary takes the script off me and he's reading it and going all gaga. And he gets to a part and he says to me, oh, Heather, you have to change something here. You've got it wrong. And I said, that's fine. Anything that's not correct, happy to rewrite it. I said, well, what part is it? And he pointed out the scene where they are intimate. And he looked, he said, you can't have this. You have my parents, you know, making love. I looked over at Lully and his head drops down to the floor. And once again, that smile comes on his face. And I said to him, Lully, do I have to take this out? And he shook his head, no. I said, is it true what you told me? And he shook his head, yes. Gary stands up, whacks his dad over the head with the script. And screams at him, how could you? How could you sleep with my mother before you were married? Come on. Lully and I continued with our coffee, and Gary went to find something stronger to drink.
Yeah, no one wants to hear about how mum and dad getting it on, even in such circumstance, even in those extraordinary circumstances.
He slept with his mother before they were married. But Lully did, just prior to him leaving, he looked up for the first time, looked his son in the eye and said, you had to be there. Said it all.
Did he come to know gypsies while he was in Auschwitz?
Yes. Very, very moving time when he spoke of them. He was put into what was known as the gypsy camp because he was given his own room there. The SS thought he needed protecting, that being privileged, that the other prisoners in the men's block might want to attack him. Some of that did go on. Quite a bit of it actually went on. He never had any problem. He would go back to the men's block all the time to visit them. So the men in that block never in any way saw him as being a collaborator or in any way doing anything other than a job. Yes, he was working for the SS, but hey, so were they. They were building blocks. They were working in the administration building. They were going through the prison's belongings. Everybody was working for the SS. The difference with him was that he was one of a kind. But he had this room in the gypsy camp at the front of the block. And when the gypsies started coming in, he either had to ignore them or get to know them. Now, the gypsy camp in Birkenau, quick history lesson, was the only area in Birkenau that had families, grandparents, parents, children. And yes, in his block, he had all those three generations. and that the kids wanted to play with him. In winter, they wanted to play soccer with balls made of snow. They wanted to talk to him, hang from him. And so, yes, he broke down and he started getting to know them. And he freely admitted to me that in another life prior to that, if he had seen a gypsy, he possibly would have crossed the other side of the street. And funny enough, when he said that one day to several gypsy men, they kind of looked at him and gave him the death stare and went, you know what, if we had seen you walking towards us, we probably would have crossed the street too. But yes, he befriended them, which made their death one night when all 4,500 gypsies were taken from the gypsy camp and killed that night and that day, all the more painful to him.
He said he saw Dr. Joseph Mengele while he was in Auschwitz.
Yes.
The famous angel of death, the man, the Nazi doctor who performed human experiments, unspeakable human experiments. Mm-hmm. Are you sure that's what he saw? I mean, there were many doctors there, many people claim to have. What persuaded you that he had?
Two things. A, he told me, and he was very clear, because he worked with Mengele. He would be at the selections with him. Other doctors were too, but he pointed out exactly who Mengele was. His name was said to him very early on when Mengele arrived, because that was actually his minder who warned him, be careful of that one. And many times Mengele would stand beside Lully and actually utter the words, oh, one day, Taravera, one day I will take you. And he was the only person who there, he said, really terrified him. And that terror played out 60 years later when Lully took me to the Holocaust Museum in Melbourne. And he was walking around as my living guide. And he's quite clinical, telling me what we were seeing and describing what the different parts of the exhibits were. And he got a little bit ahead of me and I didn't realise. And all of a sudden I heard this voice screaming in this otherwise quiet museum. You bastard, you fucking bastard, you bastard. I ran and everybody else in the museum ran to him. And I saw him standing a foot away from a photo of Mengele, his finger waving at him. He was terrified. And he had to be assisted out of the room and we had to spend some time trying to settle him down. But that recollection, yeah, there was the proof I knew, because that photo was of Mengele taken in Auschwitz in his white doctor's coat.
Auschwitz-Birkenau was in Poland, and that meant, as the end of the war was approaching, the Red Army, the Soviet Army, was invading from the east. And we know that as the Russians came closer, the Germans dismantled that camp and moved, exterminated more prisoners, moved mm-hmm. others further west into the kind of German heartland, if you like. What happened to him and what happened to Gita as Auschwitz had to be abandoned?
Yes, they knew that people were being abandoned and he was hearing, because he was in the administration building and he would hear that the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. He just said, well, for God's sake, hurry up and get here. 2 days before the Russians arrived, the 25th of January, and we've got the documents that actually prove this, Gita was taken with all the women in Birkenau on a death march. He stood there watching her and the woman leaving, trying to reach out to her, trying to get from her where she came from. Gita had been very closed about surviving there. She didn't think she would. And so she didn't tell him too much about herself. And he had to watch her and all the women walk out. And then the gates were slammed shut on him. He was now shut back in.
And she was gone.
And she was gone. She was gone. 2 days later, the last day that the Germans held Auschwitz-Birkenau, the 27th of January, a day we now recognize as Holocaust Day around the world, he was put on a train by Beretsky, by his minder. He sort of said, oh, look, they're taking all these men on a death march. So a lot of men were taking on a death march. And he took him out and said, get on this train. It's going to another camp. You might survive. Now, I know that the fact that this SS person who ended up being charged and found guilty of war crimes at the Frankfurt war trials did this simple act of kindness on this last day, in this last moment. Lully was then put on another cattle train. Here we go again. And was taken to another camp called Mauthausen. From there, he hung around because it was just people being brought there. And clearly, the Germans and the SS running that camp were on edge. Things were changing in their world. And then came the day he said, enough, I'm out of here. And he went and dug his way out underneath the fence.
Oh, he escaped.
He escaped. He ran.
Where did he go?
He established that he was very close to what was actually the Danube River, where they were being held. And there was forest, and he could hear the water. And he got into the forest and managed to get to the river. And you've got to bear in mind that it's sort of February, middle of winter still there, full of snow. Mm. And he could hear the shelling taking place across the river, the Russians on one side and the Germans on the other. So he threw himself in the river and tried to swim, but the current dragged him down and literally under the crossfire of the warring armies. And so in the end, he played dead. He didn't swim. He didn't move. He just let the current take him. And he did get to the other side. And after collapsing and regaining consciousness, he found his way up an embankment, and there was a road, and there was the Russian army marching towards him.
So he was picked up by the Russian army eventually?
Yes.
Well, what did they do with him once they got hold of him?
Well, initially he went up to the first soldiers he saw and tried to identify himself. You know, I'm a prisoner, Slovakia, showing his number. But that meant nothing to them. And he said actually the first prisoners who he introduced himself to, in Russian, just looked at him and said, oh, fuck off. Okay then, once again. He walked a little bit further down and a vehicle was coming to him, an open jeep. And they stopped and asked him, you know, who are you, mate? And he's thinking he was being the right thing, spoke in Russian. I'm a Slovakian prisoner. I have been imprisoned for 3 years. I'm trying to get home. And one of the officers in the back of the jeep was an officer, rank unknown. And he went, you speak Russian? And he said, yes. And he then boasted, and I speak German and I speak Polish. And he went, we have a job for you. Get in. All of a sudden, he's put into this vehicle. It turns around and they head back the way they were coming. Through a small town or a small village, up a road to what he described as this massive castle come chalet. Immaculate grounds. And there, the Russian hierarchy had made their headquarters for that area of Germany.
What job did they give him there in this castle he suddenly found himself in?
He's in a castle. He's told to clean himself up. He's given in a beautiful room and a bathroom and a wardrobe of the previous owners to get himself kitted out in. And 5 kilometres away from there was the village that he had driven through. Now, these were some serious brass from the Russian army that were being housed there. And what they wanted each night was entertainment. So they made him a pimp.
So he went to the village to procure girls.
He was told, he was given money and jewels that belonged to the owners of the castle to go every morning into the village and arrange for 6, 7, 8 girls who would want to come and party that night. He would give them half the money or the jewels up front, the other half on arrival. And then he and another, he was taken there with a Russian officer. They would go back, pick the girls up at a designated place, take them back to the castle. They'd party, 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 go home, do it all again tomorrow.
So then he escaped the Russians, which was probably a very good idea because he might well have been shot by the NKVD at some point or whatever their successors were.
Yeah, sooner or later. He was seeing things and, it's amazing if he could have been able to get that information to possibly the Allies about who was being housed where and the fact that they were running significant parts of the war from there.
So then he got back to Bratislava.
He did.
This is post-war Bratislava now.
He did. He decided enough once again. He had been pinching money and jewels all along. He wasn't handing back everything that he paid the girls. He had them all being hidden in his cuff of his pants and socks.
So then he's back in Bratislava. Mm-hmm. How did he even begin to go looking for Gita, assuming she was still alive?
He went home to Krumpaki immediately. He needed to know who of my family have survived.
And how many had survived?
His sister.
Oh, dear.
That was it. He had no idea what happened to his parents, his brother, his sister-in-law and his nephews. But he's his sister, and he told his sister about Gita, and she pretty much said to him, well, what are you doing here? Go and find her. So back to Bratislava. And he was told that the place to go was the Red Cross. Go there, register your name, look for her name. She may have registered if she's made it back. And he'd bought a horse and a little cart, and he was on his way to the Red Cross into the little horse and cart, and Gita was walking down the street with two of her friends. She actually saw him because it was unusual to see, she said, this weird little man, this man in this horse and cart. And she stepped out in the road in front of the horse and stopped the horse. He staggered down and fell to his knees.
So they got married.
They got married.
Migrated to Australia.
Yes.
To Melbourne. Their son Gary was born.
Mm-hmm.
What did Gary say about the looming memory of the war and the Holocaust in the family home? Did he have much of that as he grew up? Because I know people who have, you know.
Yes and no is the answer. Yes from his dad, no from his mum. His mum was a closed book. She would not talk about it. They made him, when he was a teenager, watch the World at War series on his own. They wouldn't sit with him.
Well, they'd plonk him in front of the telly and then...
Pretty much, and we're in the other room. And after that, his father would say to him, ask me anything. I will tell you anything. Anytime he went to his mum and say, Mum, tell me what happened to you. No, there was nothing to be said by Gita.
Did they keep their tattoos?
Lully did till the day he died. Gita, about 10 years before she died, because I never met her, I never got the opportunity to ask her why after all that time. But Lully said she came to him and said, take it away, make it go away. I cannot wake up anymore and look at this number. So 10 years before she died, she had hers removed.
Gary's written a piece at the end of your book. What does he make of reading his father's story?
He read the first page, put it down for 3 weeks before he could go back to it. He now seems to be quite delighted that his family story is out there. He seems very, very proud of his parents and the fact that their story is now going to be known around the world. He's very proud.
How did the marriage work in pleasant post-war Melbourne once you take the kind of intensity of their relationship within Auschwitz, once you take it out of that and you put it in Melbourne, where you go to Bourke Street to do the shopping and get on a tram, and it's
life goes on.
Life goes on. How did the marriage? Did the marriage thrive? How did it go in these post-war years in Australia?
I'm led to believe from Lully and from friends of theirs. I met several of their friends who had also been survivors, that it was a wonderful marriage. There was no doubt, and I've got so many photos of the two of these, where in each one of them, one or other is looking at the other person. And until the day they died, he could not take his eyes off Gita and vice versa. And it just was a marriage, a relationship, a love that just knew no bounds. Nothing got in the way.
So she died in 2003.
Yes.
Gita did. So they were together nearly 60 years
in
the end. He must have been shattered by her death.
Absolutely. As Gary said, it was the only time he ever saw his father cry. When the doctors came out and said that she had passed. And at that point, all Lully wanted to do was join her.
What were his last days like?
He lived at home up until 3 days after he turned 90, when he had a massive stroke. And Gary phoned me and told me that he was in the Alfred Hospital and that he was not going to recover. And I will be forever indebted to Gary that he said to me, I want you to go and see Dad. You're the only person I'm going to let be with him because you had this significant role in his life. And so I did. I went in one evening and sat with him for a couple of hours on my own until the doctors kicked me out. And literally the last words I said to him when I got up and kissed him on the cheek and said to him, I will never stop trying to tell your story. I promise I will never stop. That was in 2006, and yes, I'm sorry, folks, it took me a long time. But he died that night, a couple of hours later. Now, one thing I'm very happy to say is that 10, 12 days ago, I visited Lully and Gita, and I had a chat to them, and I got to tell them. I kept my promise, Lully.
Did the doctors know who he was?
They didn't, and when I was leaving, I actually said to, there was a doctor and a nurse came in, and I sort of said, you look after him, this man is living history, you give him the best care. And I knew they would. Hey, I worked in a hospital, everybody got good care. And they asked me, yeah, what do you mean? And they said, we saw the number. I gave them about a 2-minute spiel on who he was. The nurse came around to the other side of the bed, held his other hand, tears streaming down her eyes, and the doctor was choking back. And that's how I left them.
What is this story anyway, to your mind? Is it, well, it's clearly a love story. Is it a special kind of love story, or is it just a peculiarly intense love story?
It's a story of these two ordinary people who were living in an extraordinary time. Yes, they were deprived of their name, their freedom, their life, reduced to a number, and they survived, and they went on and had this amazing life. Now, one thing that Ladi was also very clear on to me, they survived where millions didn't. And he always wanted it known that those people who didn't survive were in no way lesser people. They didn't have a choice. They stood in front of those selectors who went left, right, left, right, left, left. And yes, that survivor guilt he carried to his grave. And yes, that's a really strong point, and I wish to make it time and time again. Those people who did not survive, they did nothing wrong.
Do you miss him?
Utterly. His photo is on my desk beside my children and my grandchildren.
Thank you so much for telling your story today, Heather.
Thank you, Richard.
Heather Morris is the author of The Tattooist of Auschwitz.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Don't forget, we're on Facebook. We get all your messages and read every single one of them. And we're on Twitter as well. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.